Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Metastatic Breast Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. This program is a follow-up to a live CME activity we conducted in Chicago during the ASCO meeting in early June. I met with Professor Giuseppe Carigliano from the European Institute of Oncology in Milano, Italy, to further discuss many of the issues that came up during the meeting. To begin, he commented on some of the thoughts he has as he thinks about encountering a patient for the first time with metastatic breast cancer.
Well, the first thing I do usually, since sometimes you see this patient for the first time in your life, and so you have in front of you a woman, in the majority of the cases with an husband, sometimes with a son or daughters, and she is very worried about this. Because she arrived after consulting Dr. Google, and she realized already that she has a metastatic disease that is incurable. And maybe you have been selected because she downloaded a video from the website, seeing you discussing with Dr. Neil Love. And maybe you presented an important study that can improve her survival. So what I do with this type of patients, usually I say, I am sorry because you have a metastatic disease. It's really important to be empathic with them. The second thing that I do is try to recognize that there is a solution for this problem. So we have a treatment. You can be better. You can improve your clinical situation. And the third thing I do usually is to be honest with them. So I say them that we can take care of her, but we cannot cure the disease. But finally, what I do every time is to give hope. Because now we have some really important treatment in some disease like the HER2 positive disease. Even if you are metastatic, if you have one single bone lesion or one single liver lesion, the quality of care and the efficacy of the treatment you propose is so outstanding that I have many patients that, despite metastatic disease, they can live 10 years or longer than 10 years, and specifically in their HER2 positive disease. So compassion, being honest with them, be empathic, and then explaining them that this is a metastatic disease, but giving hope. This is my approach.
So as we go through some of these topics, I'm going to bring up some of your papers. And one that I think, you know, maybe we can emphasize as we go through various parts of metastatic disease, of course, that was the topic that we were covering. I noticed you did a number of papers related to the issue of quality.
Yes.
And some of them looked like they pretty deep, you know, exploration of the issue. And you thinking about that woman that you just described, you know, how does, and you know, the whole issue of patient-reported outcomes and advocacy, et cetera, where does that come in? And you're, again, in your initial discussion with the patient, initial thoughts about the patient.
Well, you know, I believe when you have a metastatic disease, you need not only to improve overall survival, median progression-free survival, but you need to realize that the quality of life is almost important. And today we have a specific tools that were not available 20 years ago. You have digital tools, and the patient can really report toxicity and quality of life by their self. You know, I remember a trial that has been done 10 years ago comparing a self-reported outcome or patient-reported outcome respect to assessment of quality of life and toxicity by the medical oncologist. That was completely different, because the time you collect toxicity in front of a patient can be 7 to 8 minutes. So say, how are you? Did you have any side effects? Oh, I had a little bit of diarrhea. So you report one, and one as a grade of toxicity. And so the quality of life is excellent according to the doctor assessment. But if you have a diarrhea grade one for 10 to 15 days or for all the intercourse of the cycle, of course, this means that your quality of life is very poor. So I remember we did the patient reported outcome analysis in the Destiny Breast 03, that was the prospective randomized trial evaluating trastuzumab deruxtecan versus TDM1. And of course, the PRO were really excellent when reported by the patients, because trastuzumab deruxtecan can really give a rapid response with a symptomatic improvement. And if you check that paper, the time to first hospitalization was almost 1 year with trastuzumab deruxtecan versus a few weeks for TDM1. So wow. This means, of course, that we need really to collect the data of quality of life, but completely reported by patients, not by the investigators. Because as an investigator, I have many bias. First, you have a drug that works, so you are convinced that you will change the standard of care. And when you have positive data of a drug, you have a lot of bias, and you can under-evaluate the quality of life of patients.
Yeah, that's really a great point. It kind of leads into some of the things I was going to get into. And one that came out at the meeting, which has been out there for a while, but I thought we had a little bit of an interesting twist on it. It was very simple, choice of CDK inhibitor in the first line setting. And you may remember that we had one case presented of a patient who was on ribo. The patient had hepatotoxicity. They tried to adjust the dose and going back and forth trying to keep them on ribo. And then we had another doc saying, well, I don't even use ribo in older patients. I just use it in younger people because the older people, they don't like it. And you know, they're still getting 5 years out of palbo. And it made me wonder, you know, about this issue of sort of chasing the data. Are we like, you know, we're so fixed on overall survival that we don't really look at the patient. Any thoughts?
You know, before the publication of the final data of the old CDK4/6 inhibitors, I published the paper, are all CDK4/6 inhibitors created equal? You know, when you have a patient in front of you, you have to consider that all trials with CDK4/6 inhibitor had as a primary endpoint progression-free survival. And all CDK4/6 inhibitor improved median progression-free survival in all the clinical trials. So selection of a CDK4/6 inhibitor should be based also on patient expectation, patient comorbidities, and sometimes patient preferences. For me, palbociclib is still an excellent agent. It's my first choice for patients with comorbidities or for patients that are elderly, because the quality of life is very good. And I have personally patients for more than 4 years with palbociclib. Of course, if you have a younger patient that is premenopausal with an non-metastatic disease, you should be honest. You should discuss with her the secondary outcome of the clinical trials, explaining that some CDK4/6 inhibitors improved also overall survival. And that's why in younger patients, of course, my first option is ribociclib. But I must confess that I had some younger patient developing liver toxicity that is very common with ribociclib. And despite I reduced the dose to 400 milligram, 200 milligram, there was still liver toxicity. And then what I did is to switch to another CDK4/6 inhibitor. And I gave palbociclib, and there was absolutely no liver toxicity. So case-by-case discussion, being honest with the patient, presenting the data, and explaining the magnitude of clinical benefit for any CDK4/6 inhibitor. But don't forget that we cure patients and not breast cancers.
Where does abemaciclib fit in the metastatic setting? Are there any particular patient profile? Do you feel like there's positive survival data there as well?
Yes, I believe in the endocrine-resistant disease, we have clear overall survival benefit. My preferred treatment with Abema is for patients with poorly, rapidly progressive disease and main liver disease. Usually is an excellent agent. You can achieve an impressive response rate, and you can improve also the outcome. You know, it's a different CDK4/6 inhibitor. It's more on target on CDK4. And that's why maybe in the Aruvant setting, there is a clear benefit of abemaciclib in the monarchy trial.
So let's talk about patients who have progressive disease on CDK inhibitors. I think this is one of the more complicated areas in oncology nowadays, which of course now also has a very strong biomarker component. And of course, we talked about that at the meeting. So I guess a number of questions came up at the meeting, and I'm just kind of curious what your take is. One is, we talked about the patient who's both PIK3 positive and ESR1 positive. I'm curious about how you think through that scenario.
But, you know, the median progression-free survival post-CDK4/6 inhibitor with alpelisib, according to the BILIV trial, is 7 months. The median PFS of elacestrant in those patients who received more than 1 year or close to 18 months of first-line CDK4/6 inhibitors is 8.5 months. So if you have both an ESR1 mutation and a PI3 kinase mutation, of course, my preferred choice is elacestrant in endocrine-sensitive disease, because you may have a longer benefit in this patient population with the monotherapy. So why should I consider a PI3 kinase inhibitor like alpelisib inducing hyperglycemia, cutaneous rash, and sometimes also diarrhea? A different scenario is with capivasertib. Of course, now you have patients with PI3 kinase mutation, AKT mutation, or PTEN deletion that may derive a benefit from the combination of fulvestrant of capivasertib. It's a good treatment option. There is less toxicity respect to alpelisib, but don't forget that in the post-CDK4/6 inhibitor setting, median PFS with capivasertib plus fulvestrant is 5 months.
How do you find using capivasertib, and particularly the schedule, you know, the 4 days on and 3 off? How does that work with patients? And what do you see toxicity-wise, particularly compared to alpelisib?
Well, you know, capivasertib is much more better tolerated than alpelisib in the metastatic setting. If you have a fit patient, of course, you don't have hyperglycemia in terms of diet. Cutaneous rash is less common. Diarrhea can be an issue, but you can manage events eventually with loperamide or any other treatment. I prefer to use capivasertib for those patients that eventually progress to CDK4/6 inhibitors and have, let's say, AKT alteration that is very common, quite common like PI3 kinase. And of course, in this patient population that is clearly resistant, a combination drug can give a better control of the disease. In the endocrine sensitive, as I said before, if you have ESR1 mutation, I prefer to give a monotherapy.
You know, that was another issue that I'm not sure has really gotten out there successfully, about how important it is to look at the time the patient was on a CDK inhibitor. And as you were referring, you know, endocrine sensitivity or resistance, is generally, are you looking at a year or less as being endocrine resistant, or what numbers do you use?
Yes, we use usually the ABC ESBON definition. So progressing within 1 year of first-line CDK4/6 inhibitor is considered usually an endocrine resistant disease. But you know perfectly that the majority of the patients, almost 70% of them, can receive a CDK4/6 inhibitor when relapsing or first line for more than 1 year. So it's quite common to derive a longer benefit by first line CDK4/6 inhibitors. A different patient population is the patient population that relapsed during adjuvant endocrine therapy. This is a clearly resistant population in which first line usually is fulvestrant plus a CDK4/6 inhibitors. And usually within 1 year, they will relapse. And that's why here you need to consider something different, like a chemotherapy, or now that we have trastuzumab deruxtecan in HER2-low, trastuzumab deruxtecan.
Right. And of course, another issue that we got into there was that you were talking about elacestrant, but there are a couple other SERDs in development that are not currently available, camizestrant and imlunestrant. And I think Sarah Hurvitz was talking about her perception that, I think what she said was, they seem equal efficacy-wise, they have slightly different tolerability. It sounds like CDK and a lot of other situations in oncology where you have multiple, you know, PARP inhibitors, multiple agents within the same class, where you can't really differentiate efficacy, but they have a little bit different tolerability. Do you sort of buy into that? Another thing she mentioned was bradycardia, I think was seen maybe with elacestrant mainly. I saw a bunch of papers. I guess you have an interest in cardiac issues in oncology also. I was curious, and I guess elacestrant's on the list now. So again, any thoughts about these three agents and, you know, where things are heading? Do you think eventually they'll be combined with other things, and whatever trial successfully combines them, that's how they're going to be used? And what about cardiac issues?
But, you know, elacestrant specifically is not giving bradycardia. It's more the PROTAC inhibitor that can give to you a bradycardia. Because, you know, the mechanism of action of PROTAC is a little bit different. They degrade the estrogen receptor at the level of the proteasoma. And so it means you can also induce a QTC prolongation and the bradycardia. But as you correctly stated, we have different oral SERD. Camizestrant, that is going to be approved soon. Imlunestrant and elacestrant. Camizestrant is a different mechanism of action of elacestrant. It's more on target and so can induce also some problems on the cardiac level. I mean, a QTC prolongation is more common with camizestrant than with elacestrant. And another point, camizestrant can induce also fatigue much more than elacestrant. It can induce also diarrhea because, as you know perfectly, estrogen receptors can be also expressed in the gastrointestinal tract. And you may have, with these agents, sometimes diarrhea. So the magnitude of clinical benefit of all these agents usually is between 7 and 9 months, according to the endocrine sensitive or the endocrine resistant population. So the first question is whether you can combine with other agents. And we have data with imlunestrant. Imlunestrant has been combined with abemaciclib with a very good activity, very similar to the combination with the AI, but has been combined also with everolimus with an impressive median progression-free survival improvement in a small cohort of patients progressing to first-line CDK4/6 inhibitors. I don't know how much of these agents would be incorporated in clinical practice. I see for the majority of them a role in the second line setting. Will be very difficult to position them in the Aruvant setting because a safety profile of an oral SERD is completely different respect to tamoxifen or NAI. But you know that there are some trials that are based on interception of ESR1 mutation. Specifically, the SERENA-6 is testing patients for ESR1 mutation without radiological progression. And once you intercept the ESR1 mutation, you anticipate the use of the oral SERD, like in the PADA-1 trial. So if this trial will be positive, we will have a new patient population that are patients without radiological progression, but with an ESR1 mutation that has been intercepted with the liquid biopsy.
No, I love that concept. And I see that being done in other tumors, so at least conceptually the same. But, you know, the other thing, though, is so, I mean, the way things work in oncology, it seems like when you if you have multiple agents in the same class and then you take one of them and you add it to something else and it's helpful, then usually people stick with the drug that was used in this. But you brought up a whole bunch of issues with Cami. Do you see that as a major obstacle or do you think people get used to it and be able to use it?
But this is an excellent question because, you know, you should consider that if camizestrant will be approved based on this trial, you need to test the patients every 3 months with a liquid biopsy. So maybe in the United States, there will be Medicare that will cover this. But in countries like Europe, it's important to recognize that maybe if you want me to use camizestrant, you will need also to pay for my liquid biopsy. So I deeply believe that intercepting the progression before radiological progression may improve the outcome, at least median progression-free survival. But we have also to discuss about sustainability and, of course, also about patient compliance, because in order to do something like this, you need an access every 3 months on a standard of care to do this liquid biopsy.
So let's move on and talk about HER2-low and ultra-low disease and HER2 assays. you know, it's really incredible for us. Now we're trying to deal with everybody else in oncology. You know, we've been dealing with, you know, TDXD and breast cancer, of course. Then the lung cancer and GI people sort of came along, and now everybody is trying to figure out what to do, and they have no experience in this area. Particularly HER2 testing seems, it's almost scary when I hear about what's going on. So can you kind of review? I mean, we've got now, we've got the pan tumor approval for IHC 3+. We've got, you know, obviously that's a huge thing. And we've got all this data with HER2 low, ultra low. You know, we had a case the other day and people were like, can we just give it to somebody who's HER2 zero? So you've obviously been in the middle of all this. Let's just start out with HER2 testing. And, you know, even the issue of is HER2 even, I mean, I guess it's the target, but you kind of wonder what's going on in general with ADCs. You have trope ADCs where you're not even measuring it. So you can imagine that people out there in the grandstand are a little confused. So can you help us?
But first of all, HER2 is not only a predictive biomarker, but it's also a prognostic biomarker. Just to remind to you, when Dennis Lehmann for the first time described HER2, it was on Brain Mets, and the name is HER2 new, neurological. That's why it was called HER2.
Really?
And then, yes, absolutely.
Oh, that was neurologic. Wow, that's cool.
And so finally, you know, he first published this beautiful trial in the metastatic setting demonstrating that the combination of trastuzumab and taxanes may improve overall survival. And then we move it in the area one setting. First generation ADC was T-DM1, but a study has been done with T-DM1 in HER2-low. Adam Brufsky published this trial, and the response rate was very low. I remember it was 4.6% T-DM1 in HER2-low. And then there was another trial in the Aruvan setting, the NSIBP-B47, large prospective randomized trial with trastuzumab versus chemotherapy alone in Aruvan setting for HER2-low completely negative. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is another agent, is an ADC that can target also lower liver over two. But let's look in the detail in the data. The hazard ratio in HER2-low disease in the intent to treat population, including HER2-low and HER2-ultra-low, is 0.63. But if you check the hazard ratio in HER2-ultra-low, I mean any staining between 0 and 1, the hazard ratio is 0.78. And if you check the activity of trastuzumab deruxtecan in HER2-3+, the DESTINY-Breast03, the hazard ratio is 0.3. So it means that increasing level of expression over two predict an improved outcome. So it's a spectrum HER2 expression. So the most important message is that TDX may work also at lower level over two. But the more expression you have, the more benefit you will derive. And what will be essential now for our pathologists, since it's very easy to test 1+ and 2+, we have the ASCO-CAP. But ASCO-CAP is not explaining to you how to test HER2-0. That is any staining between 0 and 1+. So I believe we need a new revised version of ASCO-CAP, addressing also the issue of HER2-ultra-low. Because up to now, you know, the pathologists are really in difficulty, according to the ASCO-CAP definition, to define what is an HER2-low. So my advice is report HER2-low as HER2-ultra-low, as H0, but describe in the report how many cells are positive under 10%.
So let me go through with you a few questions related to TDXD in general and HER2-low particularly. One is the issue of sequencing. You know, we actually did a meeting, I think, a couple hours after the HER2-low data was presented a couple years ago. And immediately, people were saying, well, ER positive HER2-low, okay, TDXD first. But triple negative, there's better data with sacituzumab, so sacituzumab first. So I'm curious, particularly how you sequence those two ADCs in this setting. But one thing that I don't think we've talked enough about is the clinical status of the patient and how that affects the decision. Because to me, if you have a patient with not without visceral disease who's relatively asymptomatic, that's very different than a patient with a lot of disease and a lot of symptoms in terms of this decision. And that maybe, you know, this algorithm of, you know, one versus the other has to be, you know, maybe consider the patient's clinical status also. Any thoughts?
You know, this is an important question because we know that if you compare the median PFS with the first ADC to the median PFS of the secondary ADC in sequence, the median PFS will be shorter. So we need to understand also that once a patient progresses to trastuzumab deruxtecan and this NR2 low, of course, you will have a visual progression in the majority of the cases. And the use of a secondary ADC will have an underperformance respect to the first ADC. First, you have to consider the general condition of the patient and the performance status. Second, you have to evaluate the toxicity of the previous ADC. Because if you had only hematological toxicity, you can re-challenge with another ADC with the hope to have again a response rate and potentially an improvement in median PFS. But what to do if you had an ILD, a grade 2 ILD and a progressive disease? What to do if you have a massive gastrointestinal toxicity? What to do if you had an hematological toxicity? So I believe we need more study on sequencing of ADC, but the ideal studies should consider a model like the SONIA trial. So let's say you start with an ADC, you use it for a longer time, and then at progression, you use a chemotherapy as an interval and then another ADC. Or eventually, you consider the sequence of two ADC directly, and you evaluate median progression-free survival 2 as a primary endpoint. This is what is going to be done when testing trastuzumab deruxtecan and datopotamab deruxtecan that are an entire 2 and entire TROP 2. But we need, of course, to generate more real-world data.
Yeah, I'm just looking at one of your many papers on this topic. I like that your titles are always cool. I like them. So Think HER2 Different, Integrative Diagnostic Approaches to HER2-Low Breast Cancer, Pathologica. We don't usually read that. So I guess you got to interact with the pathologists. I mean, I guess everybody has to deal with their local pathologists as well. I mean, in terms of IHC, even at this point, in these other tumors that you mentioned, ILD, and again, you know, we're dealing with the lung. Everybody's asking, "What do we do?" type thing. In general, you know, do you think that the algorithm we've heard from the breast people is very frequent imaging, you know, as frequent as you can get it, maybe every 9 weeks? Obviously, if they have any symptoms, you need to work up. But the main thing has been grade 1, stop, use steroids, retreat. Grade 2, don't use it again. Now, that's the message. So my question to you, is that the message we should be giving to the lung and GI and all these other people about, you know, prevention and management of ILD?
Okay, the first thing is to screen, as you said perfectly. So it's important to increase awareness of the patient, but also to screen with a CT scan in order to understand when eventually the ILD is going to appear. According to the recommendation, the screening should be done every 6 to 8 weeks. What I do in my clinical practice is patients are asymptomatic, I can also delay more than the 8 weeks. The second point is to scan, because, you know, the best way to detect an ILD is not a chest X-ray, but is a CT scan, because you can identify also a grade 1 ILD. The third point is to synergize, of course, with the pneumologist, because once an ILD is detected, of course, you can start steroid treatment, but it's really important to interact with your pneumologist in order to understand which is the level of ILD and the grade of ILD and the appropriate treatment. 4, stop trastuzumab deruxtecan. Every time you have an ILD, you have to stop. Grade 1, 2, or 3, you have to stop. And finally, you have to start steroids at appropriate dose, 1 milligram per kilo if you want to have a rapid resolution. So this is the summary of what you have to do to better recognize and to avoid a fatal evolution.
So one of the other topics we talked about was the use of checkpoint inhibitors, particularly in triple negative disease. And before I ask you about the breast, I got to ask you about something I saw that's coming up. And I know you've done a lot of work combining IO with other things like Pembro. I was curious, I saw this paper, it was actually in a GYN, but I'm curious if you heard of it. Vibostolimab co-formulated with Pembro, KeyVibe-005, anti-TIGIT, anti-PD-1 co-formulation.
Yes, I know this.
About that.
Yes.
What is it? It sounds pretty cool, but what is it?
It's a bifunctional antibody. You know,
wow,
you may.
That's what it sounds like. That's what it sounds like. I thought so.
Actually,
oh my God.
Actually, you have many bifunctional antibody under development. Some of them can target two immune checkpoints, anti-TIGIT and anti-PD-L1. Some others can target anti-HER2 and anti-PD-L1. Some others can target also vascular endothelial growth factor receptor and anti-PD-L1. There are many of them under development. You know, it's a new generation of ADC that can target with the bifunctional antibody two different targets, and then you can also conjugate with the chemotherapy. So it's really complex what is going on in drug development. Please.
That's for sure. But now this is a bispecific, right?
Bispecific,
not an ADC.
I've
heard about
this. This is a bispecific, yes.
So do we know that even some kind of bispecific can cause a response like an IO?
You know, yes, can induce a response that sometimes is better than an IO. I am using now some bispecific in clinical practice. You should be aware that any bispecific can also induce more frequently or infusion reaction or inflammatory response syndrome, because they are very similar to drugs that can enhance the immune response at the limits. So you have to be very careful, because you have also to know how to manage an inflammatory response syndrome.
Well, I mean, you have CD3 bispecific, and now there's one in small cell cancer of the lung that causes cytokine release syndrome.
Correct.
So, I mean, I guess that's kind of, I guess, what you're talking about. Yes. These things sound really cool. Okay, but getting back to today and triple negative breast cancer, I guess some of the practical issues that we talked about are the patients who present with metastatic disease and, you know, getting first-line therapy with an IO plus chemo, and particularly looking at second-line therapy. Anything you want to say about that whole clinical scenario and how you approach these patients, and any advice you would give to docs in practice about this scenario?
You know, in the first line setting, it's first essential to test for PD-L1. You know, in the metastatic setting, pembrolizumab is approved only for CPS score more than 10. So if you don't test in the metastatic setting and then in the primary, because sometimes in the liver biopsy, you will not find PD-L1, but you can find in the primary tumor. So if you are PD-L1 positive, the standard of care is an immune checkpoint inhibitor plus chemotherapy. That can be any chemotherapy plus pembrolizumab or atezolizumab plus nab-paclitaxel that is only approved in Europe. The critical issue is what to do in second line. Because, you know, we don't have so many options in the second line setting. Up to now, the best treatment you can offer, if you don't have a germinal BRCA mutation, is sacituzumab govitecan. You have the data of the ASCENT trial, prospective randomized trial evaluating the activity of the entire TROP2 sacituzumab govitecan versus standard of care in patients with triple negative breast cancer. And sacituzumab govitecan improved both median progression-free survival and overall survival. We are waiting, of course, for other data, datopotamab deruxtecan. And finally, don't forget that also trastuzumab deruxtecan can be used in this setting, because if you have a triple negative, ER-positive, PR-negative, ER-negative, PR-negative, with a low level of expression over 2, trastuzumab deruxtecan can be also an excellent option.
So I want to talk a little bit about PARP inhibitors. You've written a bunch of papers there. And I guess the first question I have is, where do we stand in the use of PARP inhibitors in the adjuvant setting? And also, I've seen you have a bunch of papers about working patients up in the adjuvant setting and germline testing and somatic testing. How do you, again, outside a clinical trial setting in a community-based setting, what do you consider standard in terms of looking for, you know, BRCA and other alterations? What kind of testing do you recommend, and how does that affect the way you prescribe therapy?
According to ASCO SSO guidelines, we need to test for germline BRCA mutation any patient. I don't believe we should limit only to triple negative breast cancer patients, but also to HR positive breast cancer patients. You know that the Olympia trial was a prospective randomized trial evaluating the activity of olaparib for 1 year in both triple negative and HR positive disease. And the trial demonstrated an improvement in invasive disease-free survival, but also in overall survival. Unfortunately, the trial was only for germline BRCA mutant. But during ASCO, we had some very interesting data presented on the activity of olaparib in somatic germline, somatic BRCA mutation, and also in PALB2 germline mutation. This was a trial in the metastatic setting, very few patients, but there was a huge activity of olaparib in PALB2 germinal mutant, but also in somatic BRCA mutations. So my advice is test everybody for the adjuvant setting, because if you have an high-risk patient, HR positive or triple negative, and you are germinal BRCA mutant, you can offer olaparib that can improve overall survival.
Of course, one of the questions that comes up is, what about in the neoadjuvant setting in the patient with residual disease? Do you give a PARP inhibitor, IO, or both?
Oh, this is an excellent question. What I do in my practice, if you are an high-risk patient with residual disease and triple-negative breast cancer, I give both pembrolizumab and olaparib, because we know that essentially there is no safety issue. You can combine them. There is no evidence, because there is no prospective randomized trial. It's only an extrapolation. But I assume that if you combine both, I don't believe you will give any problem to the patient. You can do this.
So I want to talk about a few other topics. Again, I saw some papers that I was really curious about. One was in cancer treatment research. Fast mimicking diets and other innovative nutritional interventions to treat patients with breast cancer.
I was a co-author of this paper, of course. You know, now we have the fast mimic diet, finally. It means being for a long time without any food, usually in people more than 50 like me, you should fast from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. in the morning. So you should not have dinner. You know, some of these trials in other settings seems to demonstrate a better outcome in terms of control of diabetes or any other disease. And now there is a line of research, not only in breast cancer, but also in other disease, evaluating the effect of this type of diet in patients receiving neoadjuvant or adjuvant chemotherapy. These trials are, of course, ongoing. We don't have, until now, any evidence that can be useful for the patients. But I believe the study of metabolism in the future can be really important also in cancer patients, because I am sure that the activity of some drugs can be also correlated to the metabolism and to the diet. So we need to do more studies on this. This is, of course, not evidence-based until now.
So the reason I brought that up, and I've been asking people about, because I've always been interested in this, although, like you, I'm not sure exactly where it's heading, but we did a program recently on myelofibrosis with Ruben Mesa, who's a myelofibrosis guru. And we had just reviewed two papers on new agents in myelofibrosis that did not improve symptoms in people already, you know, treated with ruxolitinib. And they did a randomized study on the Mediterranean diet, which is really a low-fat diet, you know, a lot of plants and vegetables. It's simple, you know. And they saw a difference in the inflammatory symptoms.
Yes.
And that's made me think, I wonder, you know, we've always looked at diet, you know, for other reasons, but now that we have immunotherapy, I wonder specifically if there could be a connection between diet and immunotherapy. Any thoughts?
There are two different evidence from immunocheckpoint inhibitors. The first one is that potentially obese patients may derive less benefit from immunocheckpoint inhibitors. And this means that if you have an environment with a high level of inflammation, potentially you can reduce the activity of immunotherapy. Of course, these are only based on retrospective analysis. And so it means that if you have a low caloric intake and you reduce potentially all the inflammasome biomarkers, you may potentially derive more benefit from immunotherapy. And that's why some studies that have been done and are ongoing with this type of approach are mainly in triple negative breast cancer using the adjuvant immunocheckpoint inhibitors.
I've heard that there's a big U.S. cooperative group study. I think it's looking at diet intervention in the adjuvant setting. And I don't know if you, I'm not sure exactly what they're doing. I heard it's.
If you remember, there was a large prospective randomized trial using metformin.
Right, yeah.
Exactly.
But this is that.
And the
else.
Trial was completed and unfortunately was negative.
Right, right.
So you know what is Dr. Love, the most important thing when you do a trial with diet, you cannot assess the compliance because you don't know if the patient will follow exactly the low caloric intake that you are prescribing. You know, yeah, you need just a glass of wine to break the compliance. So it's very difficult to do trials like this.
So here's another topic I've been interested in, and I saw you had several papers on it. I actually was approached by a patient advocacy group, and I immediately understood the issue. It was an advocacy group for lobular cancer of the breast.
Yes.
And they were like, where's our stuff? Which I understand, you know, because lobular gets lumped in with ER positive, HER2 negative. But, you know, then they read and they see that it's not the same, you know, obviously clinically. And I see that you've had some papers looking at lobular. At this point, any sense of whether we'll ever be able to find a target there that maybe we can't find in, you know, at cadherin or anything?
No, personally, I believe lobular cancer is a different biology respect to ductal cancer. We have a lot of evidence that the presentation of lobular cancer is usually with nodal involvement, even if a small tumor is a multifocal disease. In the majority of the case, can be bilateral. Lobular cancer may derive more benefit from aromatase inhibitors respect to tamoxifen, and we have also evidence from the BIG-198. In lobular cancer is more common the upregulation of PI3 kinase mutation, so definitively I believe we need to design a clinical trial for lobular only. And the other point is we need a prospective randomized trial also to evaluate the activity of chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting in this disease. Because as you know perfectly, the first option for a lobular cancer, even if node-positive, is endocrine therapy. So for sure, we need to better understand the biology and we need to design clinical trial specifically for lobular cancer patients.
I wonder if that's going to happen, but it sounds like a great idea. Here's another topic that I saw a bunch of papers on that I was very interested in, inflammatory breast cancer and immunotherapy. And I was thinking, I don't think I've seen much on that.
Oh, we have a clinical trial ongoing, actually, using pembrolizumab plus low-dose metronomic chemotherapy in inflammatory breast cancer. Inflammatory breast cancer is a completely different disease. You know, some patients may present to you with an inflammatory disease, and these are difficult to treat cancers with less response, even if HER2 positive or triple negative, they are less responsive to the standard of care. And we really don't know very well which is the biology behind an inflammatory breast cancer. So it's essential to design clinical trial for them. There is a patient advocacy group working on this. And very few investigators all over the world. I just remember one trial of Oprugo, some trials of Massimo Cristofanilli, and my trial that is ongoing. It's a rare disease, but even if there, even if rare is there, and you need the tailored clinical trials for them.
So I guess the only last question I was going to ask you is maybe to speculate a little bit of where you think breast cancer is going to be in the next 5 years.
Oh, this is an excellent question. What I see in the future is more interception. So I believe we will have more trials of screening for the high-risk population, in which beyond MRI, mammograms, and ultrasound, you will use also liquid biopsy to intercept the disease before the appearance. This is for the primary prevention. And then in the adjuvant setting, what I see a lot is a lot of trials with liquid biopsy, in which patients under adjuvant treatment will use circulating tumor DNA to better stratify the risk. And in those patients with no clearance under the standard of care, I see new clinical trials in which the primary endpoint will be ctDNA clearance. So I see incorporation of many assays that may intercept in the adjuvant setting the progression of disease.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Carigliano, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.